Hello, this is Rob Gillis, and today I am interviewing Howard Blue, who's the town historian for the town of Copaig. Thank you very much, Howard, for coming on today.
My pleasure, Rob.
There's a few things you're going to talk about, and it's...
Okay, well, I've been researching Copaig's history since 2012. I've been the town historian for a shorter period of time, the official historian for a shorter period of time, but we first came to Copaig in 2002, I believe, and it took a while before I caught on that there's so much, so many interesting stories here. I actually started by collecting old photos from people, because I know from my own family that when an elderly person in the family dies and the relatives go through their photo albums, lots of times there are photos that nobody can recognize, because we don't live in extended families anymore. We live in nuclear families, and so a lot of times there are people whose photos are in our albums that our children or grandchildren don't know. So I thought that it would be interesting to find photos that people could tell me about and be able to record the history with those photos. And since 2012, over these years since then, the last count I took was over a year ago, I had something over 3,000 photos of Copaig and its past. The earliest one goes back to about 1895, and it's a fantastic photo of Bashbish Falls with people standing below in outfits of the period. The women were wearing big floppy hats and long dresses, and the men were dressed in a kind of a formal style. And and I've got a number of photos that, you know, come up close to the present. I mean, not right away, but photos of the 20s and 30s. And people every so often contact me instead of my having to call them. One time, I got an email from a woman who had never been in Copaig, but she did various kinds of craft projects with old photos. Her daughter knew that, and so her daughter was in an antique shop or someplace and saw a photo album that she thought that her mother might like to have, and she bought the photo album. And it turned out that that photo album somehow it had belonged to an older previous town historian in maybe the 70s or so. And that photo album had pictures of one of the most interesting people in this town, Henry Astor and his wife. And Henry Astor was a grandson of once the country's wealthiest man, John Jacob Astor, who started making his money as a fur trader. And she contacted me, the woman who now have these photos, and she had seen my Copaig History Facebook page and wondered if I could tell her something about these people. And also, either she asked or I asked about getting copies of them, and she sent them to me, and they're just amazing photos. Astor had a mansion built in West Copaig, and I remember some stories about it, that at one point he had the floor of one of his rooms paved with silver dollars, which is pretty extravagant. Wow. And, you know, so that was one source of photos that I got. But I'll tell you, the first person that I ever got any photos from was a neighbor of a 3-4 minute walk from my house, whom I didn't know at the time that I went there, but people had referred me to this person. His name was Charlie Knox. Charlie was a former postmaster for Copaig, and he had one of the biggest collections of old postcards from the town. And I told him what I wanted to do, that I had was starting this Facebook page, and I wanted to just scan his, if he would let me do it, scan his postcards, which he showed me right away when I was there. And I wound up leaving his house, mind you, you know, I'd only known him for half an hour, with two photo albums under my arms that he lent me. He trusted me like that. And that's the thing about small town life like this. And so I came home, I scanned the postcards, and then the next day I returned them to him. But that was what got me started. And then the rest is history, okay? So let me stop and see if you have any questions at the moment.
I guess that began your request for finding more of the history of Copaig, these photos,
right.
And it leads you to the next step. I guess after this point, what did you then do?
So I started to interview some of the old timers in town, who had stories that go back, that went back to the 1920s and earlier. And one of the early ones that I spoke to was a woman named B. Bristol was her maiden name. And her father had started a business in town that was one of the most successful ones. He sold hay, he sold feed and lumber and coal. And of course, everybody eventually wound up going and patronizing this business. And she had stories about when her mother first came here, when her father and mother first got married. Her mother if I remember correctly, her mother was the mayor of Hudson, or a former mayor of Hudson. And Hudson at that time was way ahead of Copaig in terms of things like, you know, it was a city, and Copaig was a tiny dairy farming town, and Copaig didn't have electricity yet. So she told me that her mother on weekends used to want to go back to Hudson because she was a little fed up with being in such a hick town that didn't even have electricity. Of course, eventually it did have electricity. And I'll just say, by the way, that another little spin-off of that story is that her father, at one time, hired some people to harvest the ice from the pond that I'm now looking at in Copaig, Robinson Pond. But also, I think he considered starting a little business generating electricity at the dam. I don't know that he ever did it, but the person who owned the mansion and once owned all of Taconic Shores, which is a big community in Copaig, actually did have a generator there and sold, as I was told, sold electricity to some of his neighbors. So that was one person, B. Bussett, was her later name. And then I also went to see Vanna Hotelling, whose father, Frank Stang, was, how can I describe him? Well, he was a popular person in town. He owned the gas station, one of the gas stations. And people used to gather quite often and listen to the ball games on the radio at Frank's. And have coffee or whatever at his place, and exchange gossip and things like that. Frank was a real sort of a center of the town for a long time, a very popular and beloved figure. I didn't know him, but I've you know, heard so many stories about him. So that was the second person. And then there were five sisters whose grandfather had started the telephone company in Copaic, and that's the Ackley family. And a friend and I went to interview all together at once three of the sisters who were available, and we got some of the stories about the beginnings of the phone company. And the girls sometimes would get involved in, you know, as children in a business family get involved in some aspects of the business. And one of the sisters actually wound up running the business for some time. So that's a third person. Now, I have lots of stories and more than I could possibly tell you in the time that we have allotted. Okay, well, when we spoke in advance of this conversation, I mentioned to you that I was working on a story, which I've since finished, that I will be submitting for the town newsletter for the July edition that's coming up. And that would be the story that I call The Clash of, how did I phrase it? The Clash of Two Legalities. And it's, in a way, it's a history story, but it also comes right up to the present. So this is certainly one of Copaic's biggest stories. In fact, it's in the history books, a part of it. Howard Zinn, the very highly respected social historian, wrote a history of the United States, and in that book, he included the story about the leader of an anti-rent group who came to Copaic on December 11th, 1844. Now, I should explain what I mean by anti-rent. In the 1840s and for many decades prior to that, practically nobody could own land in Copaic and in surrounding areas because the Livingston family, which got a grant from the king with the help of the governor of New York State, owned all the land. And so if you wanted to farm in this area, you had to become a tenant farmer, very much like the tenant farmers of the feudal era. Which meant you paid your rent not in money, but in crops or in animals. Well, in good times, people could afford to pay the amounts that the Livingston family unilaterally decided on. But if there was a drought, you still had to come up with the same number of bushels of corn or whatever, or the same number of calves, whatever, and pay the Livingstons. And that was quite a difficult situation for people. Already there had been this dissatisfaction with this arrangement in the end of the 1700s. By the 1840s, it was really there was widespread discontent, and not what just with the tenants of the Livingstons, but of the other patroons, as these owners of the land were called. And so some of the farmers started to go on rent strike. We're not going to pay you rent unless you reduce the amount of crops and so on that we owe you. And it was known that there were two particular farmers in the Rojan area, of which Copaic is a part, Rojan, Hillsdale, Ancrum, Copaic, and so on. And so it was known that the sheriff was going to come through Copaic to go to these two farmers, and he had legal papers to confiscate their crops and their animals, which he was going to sell at auction. The people supporting the rent strikers were a group who dressed in bizarre disguises so that they wouldn't get arrested, because some of what they were doing was going to get them in trouble, perhaps. So they dressed in these outfits and called themselves the Calico Indians. Of course, there never was any such tribe of Calico Indians. It refers to a fabric, right? And they also had masks on. So when the sheriff came into Copaig on the 11th of December of 1844, a large crowd had gathered in the town. And as the story goes, the sheriff went into Sweet's Tavern, maybe to take a break and have a drink or whatever, or he was invited in. And there he was confronted by a physician named Smith Boughton. Boughton was not from Copaig. He was from farther up in a part of the state called the Helderbergs, across from Albany, I guess. And Smith Boughton said to the sheriff's name was Henry Miller, Sheriff, we know what you've come here for, and we're not going to let you confiscate these possessions of these farmers. They worked hard for them. And the sheriff said, well, I will do my best to do what I was sent on this mission to do, and so be it. So he was not going to fight Boughton, especially since he had all these supporters with him. And to make a long story short, the sheriff went to the two farms, was stopped from taking anything, just by words. He didn't try to physically fight with him. And on his way back through town, he stopped at this tavern again. It was called Sweet's Tavern. And at that point, Boughton grabbed the legal papers that Sheriff Miller had with him, and he threw them on a fire that his supporters had started, and they were destroyed. A week later, in another town, Boughton was arrested, and a couple of his supporters were too, and they were brought into the county seat, and put in jail in Hudson. And there was a mistrial, but then some months later, a trial went through, and he was convicted of the crime of seizing these papers and what might one think would be an appropriate penalty for seizing papers from a sheriff. Someone might say a month in jail. Somebody might say a year in jail. But Boughton was given a life sentence for taking those papers. He went up to Dannemora prison, and then he was held there for a year and a half or whatever, and the new governor came into office in Albany, and he pardoned Boughton and the others. But in 1845, the year after the incident in Sweet's Tavern in Copaig, the New York State Legislature decided to try to counter the actions of these Calico Indians, and they passed a law banning the wearing of masks. Now, I just used that word, masks. You and I have used that word many times in the last couple of months because we wear masks. But guess what? Until around the end of May of this year, because of that law that was passed, because of that incident in Copaig and some other associated incidents, we were breaking the law. We were protecting ourselves and protecting our health, but we were breaking the law. So somebody told the New York State Attorney General earlier in the year, Letitia James is her name, that the governor's executive order was out of line, and so the state legislature and Governor Cuomo passed a law that rendered null and void the original law that was passed because of the Kopech incident. History is interpretation of the past, and historians do and should argue, because when you're trying to figure out, when you've got a set of information, what does it mean when you try to determine cause and effect? That is not something that jumps out of you. You have to work it out. You have to figure it out. So this kind of story, you know, is very much something open to interpretation. Some people, many people, will say that what Smith Boughton and his associates were doing was very much ethically, morally, the right thing to do, because these people were the downtrodden farmers trying to make a living, trying to support their families, feed their families. But an unjust system, similar to the feudal system of the Middle Ages that we studied about in school, was prevailing, and it had to be dealt with. It had to be overthrown. Other people would say, oh, wait a minute. These people broke the law. Smith Boughton, maybe he didn't warrant life imprisonment, but he warranted some penalty because he broke the law. He took those papers. So you've got two different kinds of interpretations there. And that's what gets my juices flowing about history. We try to interpret the past, and it has relevance, as I've just demonstrated, to the present. One can make one's own interpretation, but you have to gather the facts. You know, and unfortunately, too often we hear in public life that people make claims. If you say something about someone, you need to come up with evidence. If you say something, an individual or group. What's the origins of the people who, the earliest people who came to Kopech, or the origins, let's put it like this, of the oldest families in town? You know, we see certain names that appear on the mailboxes and in the newspapers over many decades. A name like Decker, a name like Bruzy, okay? A lot of these were Dutch names, because the Dutch settled a good part of the Hudson Valley. Okay?
Oh, Howard, thank you so much. I've just finished talking to Howard Blue, town historian of Kopech, about the wonderful, lively stories and interest. And Howard, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch in the future, I'm sure.
Could I interrupt you for a second? Could I put in a little plug for a book that's going to come out probably a year from now?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've written a biography of a wealthy man, a philanthropist who lived in the Craryville area of Kopech,
yeah,
for 50 years or so. And the name of the book is going to be The Man Who Sold Superman Comic Books to the World. And it's about a man named Carol Reinstrom. And I think it's going to be a very interesting read. So thank you, Rob. Thank you very much.